Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for the first hour. I appreciate all the emails that I've been getting throughout this week, and I also appreciate all the commentary on the companies that I've been bringing on this week. It was a busy week for company updates and even some company introductions. Please, everybody, go back through some of those companies, provide me with some questions, with some feedback that I can contact those companies with, and keep the ball rolling. That being said, in this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot on this whole NERP theme that seems to be dominating the headlines. So negative interest rate policy and the potential of that coming into the U.S. Plus, we're going to dabble into a couple other investment segments as well. I'm kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer over at Bleakley Advisory Group. Also writes the Book Report website, which I will post a link to. I highly recommend checking that website out on a daily basis, where Peter breaks down economic data and some of the corresponding market moves. Peter, let's start off with NERP. You've been writing about it a lot. It's been in the headlines. The Fed and the Fed presidents are trying to walk away from going down into a negative interest rate policy. But hey, it's not out of the question. And the markets really do dictate what the Fed does. What's your thought on the whole concept of NERP?
So the mentality of a central banker is higher rates bad, lower rates good. If low rates are good, then even lower rates are even better. Rates at zero, the best. And you know what? If we have to go negative, even lower rates, even better. What they don't appreciate, and what we've seen since 2014, when we started to see negative interest rates in Europe, is that you cross a line where what is perceived to be accommodative policy ends up being highly restrictive. And to me, anything near zero, particularly below zero, is restrictive. Because when you think about what a negative interest rate is, it's a tax on capital. It's a central bank taxing the bank deposits that are left with the central bank. So to think that taxing capital is going to somehow be stimulative doesn't make any sense. On top of that, you have obviously the banks that are paying that tax, then therefore damages their own profitability. And also someone has to eat it. Now, it may not be the bank that eats it, but if it's not the bank that eats it, well, then you can be sure that they're passing it on to on top of a mortgage or a corporate loan or whatever. Then you also obviously kill the yield curve. You flatten it to a pancake. And that makes it even more difficult for banks to make money. So you damage bank profitability. And you look at Europe. Europe is mostly reliant on bank lending, as opposed to the U.S., which is more capital markets. But even in the U.S., you have plenty of small, medium-sized businesses that are reliant on bank loans. So any squeeze on that because of lower profit margins ends up leading to slower economic growth. And then you throw in the U.S. is highly dependent on its money market industry, which is a $4 trillion asset out there. And money market money is used to buy commercial paper. It's used to finance government repo. It's sort of the grease that smooths out the overnight lending markets, which we saw freeze up last September, and we saw what the Fed did in response. So you go to negative interest rates, you can imagine that a lot of that $4 trillion is going to leave money markets, therefore leaving a massive funding gap in all different short-term funding markets. And then what we've learned is it becomes a trap. The ECB and the BOJ can't get out of it. Sweden barely got out of it, but just by getting back to zero. And you can be sure that also it's created, particularly in Europe and Japan. Well, I'll say Europe right now because Japan has been away for a while, but a massive credit bubble, particularly in sovereign bonds. So you've inflated a bubble at the same time, and it's just not a sustainable situation. And I refer to it as poison for a financial system rather than anything remotely being accommodative. So I am begging the Fed not to go there. I think that we've heard from, I think, four different Fed presidents over the past couple of days or five. We heard from Powell, who was not as emphatic as I hoped it would be, but you know, did say that he's not a believer in negative interest rates, but then he caveated it by saying for now, which I wish he didn't. I wish he would have just said this is never happening here, but he did not.
Yeah, it really makes you think that the Fed, that the U.S. will be in negative interest rates at some time. Who knows when? It's hard to put a time frame on that. But
there's no reason to go there. It's not accommodative. It's not a form of easing. It's a form of capital destruction, is what it is. And I've called it before a weapon of mass confiscation.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, you mentioned the banking system, how much damage it does to bank profitability. Do you see the banking system in the U.S.? It's arguably stronger than it was back at the last financial crisis, but does that mean that banks can weather that storm?
I think U.S. banks can because they have a lot of different levers compared to European banks, for example. They're more reliant on capital markets, and that becomes an offset. But if you do look at European bank stocks, and they're down about 80% from the peak in 2007, and Japanese bank stocks are down 90% from where they were in 1989. 90% in nominal terms from where they were 30 years ago. And now, U.S. banks, from a balance sheet perspective, I think they're fine. But from a profitability perspective, they're certainly under major pressure here, particularly now that we're going to start to see a pickup in loan loss.
So what do you think ZIRP, this zero interest rate policy that we're currently in the U.S., leads to? Do you think that this is helping to support the markets, the economy, anything?
Well, it helps to support the markets for sure. It also hurts other things. It hurts savers. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago that life insurance companies are offering less life insurance policies because they're making less money on these policies because long-term interest rates are as low as they are. So now trying to get an insurance policy, you have to pay up more. So there is no free lunch here when you have rates at zero. There's certainly, you got to pay for lunch a lot when you have negative. So anything close to zero, you do a lot of damage. And it's really right now meant to help the markets in terms of valuations, and it's helping big companies push out maturities. But it doesn't make your EBITDA grow any faster, and it doesn't necessarily help you grow your earnings, because only the economy will do that. We have a solvency problem right now, not a liquidity problem, and the Fed can only address right now liquidity problems.
Yeah, it's an ugly situation that we are in, but it's not just the U.S., it's globally. And as you said, there are other major central banks that are in a negative interest rate policy and are having a heck of a time getting out of that negative interest rate policy. And I could argue that they're not going to be able to do it. How important is it in your eyes for the Fed to hold some sort of a higher rate policy because of the fact that there is a lot of debt denominated in U.S. dollars and there is still the U.S. dollar, which is the world's reserve currency?
Well, I'm sure rates will stay at zero for a while. I'm just hoping that they don't go negative. I do think, though, sometime late this year or into next year, we're going to have an inflation issue. Because you have a combination of all the money that's been printed, but you are going to have demand recover over time. And I do think that the supply side of goods and services will take time to come back. And look what we're seeing in supermarkets. You see supply side shocks to different areas of food, whether it's meats or other things, whether it's trying to get a truck to deliver your product. So we are seeing supply-demand imbalances that are going to be created, I believe, and more exposed as the economy comes back. Because the economy will rebound. I'm not saying that the pace is going to be anything good at all, but it will rebound as we reopen. Just by, you look at, we went into a depression because we closed down. So it's just by nature. But we're gonna have a much higher unemployment rate, and we're gonna see much slower growth. But we will start rebounding, and I think that there's gonna be supply side issues that are gonna stay on for a while. I mean, you look at some airline flights now. The airlines have cut so much capacity that if you want to fly right now, the plane is actually kind of crowded. And you can be sure that airlines are going to take their time in bringing back capacity, as and that demand could come back quicker. Now, you may say, well, why would demand come back quicker in flying? Well, I'm not saying it's going to be quick at all. It's going to be really slow. But as long as that demand comes back quicker than airlines' ability to bring on the supply, you could see higher prices. Now, at some point, that supply can come back. But I think temporarily, in fits and starts, you're going to see supply side inflation that will impact longer term rates sometime next year. Again, and also you can assume that central banks are going to overstay their welcome on any economic recovery here with all this easing.
Yeah, that's what central banks do, though. They hang around for too long, but that's been their status quo for a while now. When it comes to the economy, we keep on getting hit with bad economic data almost day after day, but it hasn't really had the impact on the markets at all. The markets are kind of immune to it, the argument being, let's wait and see what the economic data looks like when this restart starts to pick up in a more broad fashion. Where do you stand on just the constant bad economic data, but again, markets not responding to it?
Well, I like to give the analogy that if I bang my head against the wall and I get a headache, I'm not analyzing why I got a headache. I'm more focused on how long is it going to last. So by shutting down, we gave the economy obviously more than just a headache. We shut it down and caused a depression. But that was forcibly done. So looking at the economic data as a result of that forced shutdown, which we did in order to combat and contain the virus, it's more relevant to look at what is the pace of reopening going to look like, and what will the economy, what's the economy's growth rate going to be under those circumstances. Now, that's something that's going to play out over the next couple months, where most things will reopen. Now, the bigger things and the large gatherings, that's obviously going to be a 2021 thing. But I think that is going to be really more of a fair assessment of the economy, rather than looking at it when you bang your head against the wall.
So what do you think markets respond to the most right now? They're, for the most part, moving a little bit more sideways than they have been in terms of that volatility that we saw almost throughout this year. What do you think is going to be the major drivers for these markets in the near term?
Well, I think the stock market has really focused more on, and it explains the rally from 2,200 up to 2,900 plus in the S&P 500, is the market participants focused on the direction of the economy. You close down, that's bad. You reopen, that's good. And whereas the Treasury market, granted the Fed is trying to suppress rates, but putting that aside, the Treasury market with the 10-year yield below 70 basis points, I believe, is more focused on the degree of economic improvement. And the bond market is telling you, yeah, okay, you're going to reopen, but I think that economy, and even after, is going to be really challenged, and that there's still going to be very high unemployment. There are a lot of jobs that are not going to come back. A lot of businesses, unfortunately, not going to come back. And even those that do are going to see pretty slow foot traffic for a while. I do think at some point, so I referred recently for the stock market, so I had a sort of a hall pass in the sense that as long as things were reopening, it didn't matter what the pace was as long as things were reopening. But I think at some point, and maybe it's now, or maybe it's 2 weeks or 2 months, that the stock market's going to shift its attention to, wow, this economy is really damaged. It's going to take a long time to rebound. We're going to have fits and starts here with dealing with this virus. And I can't believe that the S&P 500 is back to where it was last October when the unemployment rate was 3.5% and things looked a lot different then compared to now.
What about the comparison of U.S. markets to other global markets? It's been a trend over the last 5-10 years that U.S. markets have outperformed almost every other market. Do you see that almost safe haven allure, and I hate to use that term for U.S. markets, creep in a bit more to investors' minds?
Well, they've already done that in piling into U.S. technology stocks and the five big cap tech names. So they've already done that. That people think that these large companies are somehow immune to this global economic collapse, to me, is complete delusion. At the end of the day, Facebook and Google, amazing companies, incredible balance sheets, but they're still advertising companies that are impacted by companies pulling back on advertising. And Amazon's unbelievable, but it's still a retailer at the end of the day. And while they're selling a lot of necessities, I don't think with the unemployment rate where it is, people are buying big ticket items on Amazon. So no one is immune to what is going on. But to your question, the rally has been very narrow. They focused in on the growth areas of where there's better growth than others. But that also then leaves a lot of valuation discrepancy between the U.S. market and those overseas.
So then, Peter, when it comes to maybe different sectors that you see as benefiting, there's no doubt that some of the safe haven sectors have done well. Precious metals are doing well, or gold more specifically. Even the U.S. dollar still continuing to hold right around that 100 level. Where are you seeing opportunities in these markets?
I still remain very bullish on the metals, the precious metals, gold and silver, probably as you know. I think when you look at the dollar, everyone likes to look at the dollar as this homogeneous thing. It's either up or down. But we know that it trades against a lot of different, and it's cross rates that matter most. And that the dollar has been in a trading range against the euro for years now. The pound, bottomed out not too long after Brexit. The yen trades pretty well against the dollar, and look at everything the BOJ is doing. The strength of the dollar has really been a bit against emerging markets that have trouble, whether that's Brazil, Argentina, Turkey. It's obviously done pretty well against the commodity currencies like the Aussie dollar, the Mexican peso, the dollar against the Canadian dollar, 140-ish. It's been what, and you'll know as well as I do that it's been trading this 135, 145 range for years now. It's not like the dollar is broken out against it. So, I think we and there's always, I always hear, oh, there's a dollar shortage, all this dollar denominated debt. No question. But, there's some emerging markets, to use that as an example, who tend to have more dollar denominated debt. In some countries, their dollar reserves that exceed the dollar denominated debt. So you can't just look at the liability side of things when you analyze this. You have to look at the asset side as well. So also to opportunities. Yeah, I because of my belief that inflation does follow from this, some of the bombed out areas of commodities, I think oil prices, when I saw negative prices for that front month future in May, I said this is what bottoms are made of. I don't know the pace of the recovery, but I do think oil prices are trying to bottom here. I think with what we're seeing, the disruptions in supply, I think agriculture is gonna bottom out here. And I do think that looking globally, the Asian economies are going to bounce back much quicker than the rest of the world. Firstly, they close first and they're reopening first. And secondly, they are used to living under these kind of circumstances from the experience of SARS. They are fine wearing a mask. Whereas here in North America, we're not used to it. This is a new world for us. So while many people do wear masks, and I think masks are hugely important, all you still need is a contingency of people out there that aren't following that, and that then could result in more of a spread. So I think Asia markets are really attractive here as well.
All right. Well, Peter, great chatting with you. Thanks for joining us on this weekend show. Again, go check out Peter's website, The Book Report, book spelled B-O-O-C-K. Peter, have a great rest of your weekend, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. You too. I appreciate having me on.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am sticking to the theme of discussing this negative interest rate policy, or NERP. This time I am chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog, which I check out every day. Now, Mark, let's do a little comparison here of NERP around the world and even some of these countries that might not be in a negative interest rate, but it's been talked about a lot and they're being forced to address it, much like the Fed. Take us through what you're seeing in a comparative fashion around the world.
Sure. So I think that you really have like three camps right now. One camp already have negative interest rates, like the European Central Bank, the Swiss National Bank, and the Bank of Japan. All three of those have been easing policy during this crisis, but none of them have gone deeper into negative interest rates. So what they've done is they've expanded their asset purchases and other things like that to provide liquidity, but have not gone deeper into negative rates. Then there's a camp, another camp of countries that do not have negative interest rates, like Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Then you have another set of countries, the U.S. and the U.K. primarily, where there are some measures, some market instruments that have gone negative. For example, in the U.S., we've got the Fed funds futures contract from April of next year, negative, implying negative yields. And underlying that, of course, you know, that's the futures contract. You can look at the underlying, which is the OIS, the overnight index swaps. And that is also showing a forward, if you have a forward curve of that, it's negative in about 2 years' time. In the UK, their two-year gilt, that's their two-year bond, has went negative. It's been negative Wednesday, Thursday, and today being Friday, 3 days in a row. And what's ironic about the US and the UK is that almost every Fed official that's spoken, including Chairman Powell, were very explicit that even though they know some countries have negative interest rates, it's not appropriate for the U.S. And the Bank of England governor, new governor, said the same thing, that yes, they're aware that other countries have tried negative interest rates, but it's nothing that's compelling them to do that. And you know, you're going to have a new governor of the Bank of Canada, and among his first, his new governor takes over next month, but some of his initial comments was essentially the same thing that the Bank of England and the Fed said, which is essentially, so far, this experiment with negative interest rates is not compelling enough for us to adopt them. Now, there is one country that has said that they would be open to negative interest rates, and that's New Zealand. But what's interesting is that when the Reserve Bank of New Zealand met, they did not cut interest rates. Their cash rate, their target rate is still 25 basis points. But what they did do is increased, doubling the size of their bond purchase program, which drove down their two-year yield to 6 basis points, essentially halved it. So the issue partly is the signaling that the RBNZ gave. And was it like serious? Are they going to do it? Or was it just flirting with it to keep interest rates low? The other country to consider in all this, maybe Norway, kind of interesting, because recently Norway surprised the market and cut their target rate to zero. And so right there on the zero cusp, it's like you could appreciate why it's possible to dip a little bit in some market rates.
So, Mark, even though we are hearing from Powell, other Fed officials, even the new governor of the Bank of Canada saying they don't want to go into a negative interest rate do you think that the market could actually force them into it?
It's a good question. I'm very reluctant. I've had this hypothesis, I think I've shared with you before, that countries that have negative interest rates have a couple characteristics in common. And the reason we have to go that route is because we don't really have a lot of experience with this negative interest rates, this era. And so what I did was I thought, well, what do they have in common? Who's adopted them? And what do they have in common? And I thought of two macro characteristics they have in common. One is a country does not have negative bond yields unless the central bank puts the overnight interest rates below zero. And those central banks that put interest rates below zero have economies that have current account surpluses. And I know sometimes we think about current account surpluses as just like your external surplus, trade surplus. But it's also, from an economist's point of view, it's this identity that basically says your current account if you have a current account surplus, it is that you have your savings greater than your investment. So it's like an identity. And so that means, so I thought then, and the bottom line here is that I did not think that countries with current account deficits could have negative interest rates. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe if they can have negative interest rates, what happens? Where is the pressure relieved? And I think what we're seeing this week in the foreign exchange market in this context of the negative interest rate is the two currencies, the two major currencies that have just performed horribly against the U.S. dollar this week, which is otherwise a pretty quiet week, has been the New Zealand dollar. It's off about 3.3%, which is in the major currencies. That's quite a large move. And the second weakest currency, now at its lowest level since those panicky days in March, is the British pound. It's lost about 2.3% of its value this week. So I think what this means is that if you have a current account deficit and you're going to have negative interest rates and you're going to have QE, that the currency then becomes the weak link, and that begins taking some of the pressure, bearing some of the burden.
What do you think that means for the U.S. dollar then? Because we continue to see the dollar hold up pretty strong, but it's not like the U.S. economy or the Fed are doing anything different than the rest of the world.
No, if it is doing anything differently, it's that the Fed is being more aggressive as far as like how big the balance sheet has increased, how quickly, like say, since the crisis. And, you know, the U.S. government is, they're already looking at a budget deficit this year of 18% of GDP, and that's even before this new package that's being sort of making its way through Congress. So when it comes to the dollar's outlook, I'm very mixed, and partly I think it means that that maybe the dollar's function might not be best understood as a currency in its own right, but rather it's like the fulcrum of a seesaw. That on one side, you have these currencies that are levered to world growth. And by growth, it's also risk appetite. When people feel optimistic about the world outlook, they're willing to take on more risks. The Australian dollar, the New Zealand dollar, the Canadian dollar do fairly well. And I've been looking for this top in the Australian dollar. And today could be the first time, the first day in more than a month, that it closes below its 20-day moving average. I think that there's a double top there in the Aussie that could bring us down towards, let me get you a target there. I think it can bring you down towards 61.70, 62 cents. And we're just, we were testing 65.60 this week. So I think that the net consequence of this, negative for the Aussie, negative for sterling, which also has the unresolved Brexit issues that it's still dealing with and coming up to some political deadlines. So those are the currencies that I'd pick on, thinking about the implications with the possibility of negative interest rates and the general risk appetites and the general risk appetites. So negative the Aussie, negative sterling. But against some of the other currencies, the dollar might be able to hold in there. I mean, I think dollar, yen, and the euro are really stuck in trading ranges, and relatively narrow trading ranges at that.
Okay. Thanks for taking a little overview there of how currencies are reacting. But in terms of whether central banks get forced into negative rates or not, it sounds like one thing that we can continue to expect is increasing QE programs. Do you see that changing at all?
So it's interesting about the QE, because what the Federal Reserve has done at its peak at the end of March, it was expanding its balance sheet. It was buying $75 billion worth of treasuries every day. It's slowing down. Now it's only doing $7 billion a day. So in some ways, I think that it's not going to be the asset purchases per se, but some of the other facilities. For example, there's a lot of pressure now coming to bear on the Federal Reserve, coming from Congress, that Congress wants the Federal Reserve to buy longer dated municipal bonds, local and state bonds. Those entities can borrow for 30 years, but the Fed is only buying three-year maturities and less. And so I can see how the configuration of what the Fed is doing or what a central bank does may need to be tweaked. Some programs aren't needed so much. Like, you know, the Federal Reserve is offering $500 billion in three-month repos. There weren't a lot of takers, so it ended that program. So I do think that there might be, you know, next month the key issue in the European Central Bank is going to be two things. One is expanding its balance sheet, buying more bonds, to your point about expanding QE, and they may make it easier to borrow from the ECB by diluting the collateral, the kind of quality of collateral, so that they may, they've already been willing to accept, say, below investment grade collateral. Maybe they will decide to buy as opposed to just collateral, lower grade quality of bonds. So I think we want to look for the programs to be expanded, the asset purchases to be expanded, but also to be tweaked to expand new entities for additional support.
Okay. So from a market perspective and individual sectors, it's been obvious to see that in this world of low, zero, or even negative interest rates, and a lot of spending coming from central banks and even governments, a few sectors have stood out. One of those sectors being gold and even gold stocks that just continue to put in some nice runs. Where do you see, is it just the gold sector that benefits from this, or are there other sectors? Where do you see the biggest beneficiaries coming from this environment that we are in?
Well, I do like the idea. I mean, usually I'm not so bullish on gold, but I do like the idea that you have, that what are the knocks against gold? Oftentimes the knock against gold is that it's not a yield-bearing asset. And now, though, with negative yields at such low yields, that opportunity cost is smaller. And I think what I like about gold as well is that it seemed to be not just a hedge on your portfolio, but it also is an asset in its own right. And so gold has had a great rally. We're actually making a new multi-year highs today, getting up to $1,750. So I've been bullish gold since about $1,400. My target was $1,700, and now I'm thinking with this new COVID, larger bank balance sheets, deeper negative interest rates, I'm thinking that maybe go on our way towards $2,000 as the next big price objective.
Hey, well, when you consider where gold is in terms of other currencies, it's already at all-time highs. Any thoughts on that, the discrepancy between gold priced in other currencies and gold in U.S. dollars?
Yeah, no, I know a lot of people look at that. I find that the difference of gold price in, say, euros is just really the dollar price of gold and the exchange rate. So in my mind, I can't really think of them together like that. But for me, the implication is that for the U.S., where the dollar has been strong, the gold is still relatively cheap. And if you have to pay other currencies, gold is getting richer, which may deter buyers.
All right, Mark. Well, we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks for taking a little look around the world when it comes to NERP and what central banks have been doing, because, boy, oh boy, they are right back into QE, and, well, they've already cut rates so low that now maybe they're saying we just can't do it anymore. But where does that all leave us as we move through the rest of this year, especially if we get another market pullback or significant market pullback? Mark, great chatting with you. Thanks for your time. Again, everyone go check out Mark's blog, Mark to Market. Thanks for your time today, Mark.
Thank you. Good luck, everybody.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody has enjoyed those fairly lengthy discussions throughout the first three segments, discussing what the Fed might be doing and this whole concept of the negative interest rate policy, or NERP. We're going to step a little bit aside from these macro conversations and wrap up the first hour with a company update from Vizsla Resources. I am chatting with the president and CEO, Mike Connert. Vizsla is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol VZLA. Also now on the OTCQB under the symbol VIZSF. Now that OTC symbol, that's a new development within the last about month. And Mike, just a quick comment from you is that something we were talking about off mic is that you guys are actually out of the gate trading some fairly decent volume in the US. Any thoughts, any comments on that to kick us off?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. We always enjoy being on your show, so thank you for having us again. And what's exciting about the OTC listing is as soon as we launched it with the QB, the U.S. market actually came awake for us, and we saw significant volume over the first let's call it 3 weeks of trading. And I think that what that affirms is that we've we do have, a bit of a larger U.S. shareholder base, which is excellent. And I think it also shows that, that the broader markets of silver and gold are starting to, pivot and look back to these developers and near-term producers in silver. So I think it's an exciting time to be listed on the QX.
Well, the stock has been performing actually quite well, so it's been a good little rebound for the stock. There's also another news release that came out this week, actually, that discussed the extension of the exploration period at this Panuku project, and it also outlined some details about pushing back some of the payments that are due to acquire these projects. Now, the Panuku project is consisting of two different assets and two different agreements. Can you take us through this extension and what it means for the company?
Sure, and just to give a couple second background, so we've consolidated an entire producing district in Mexico. We have an option to buy the mill and all the production assets of the district, but what we need to do first is develop a resource and explore for the silver and gold that's on the project. So what we did originally was sign a two-year exploration window starting in the fall of 2019. Now, we were always going to be able to execute on our business plan of putting a resource together and delineating a large resource that would give us the confidence to execute on the back end option and go into production. But, what we realized is that the market seemed to have a bit of an overhang, let's call it a timeline overhang on our story because of this tight, what was perceived as a tight timeline. So, we took that into, we were fully aware of that. And so what we did was actually extend one of the options, the Rio Panuco option, out by another year, another 12 months. And then the other one, we actually moved the Silverstone option, we moved out another 6 months. But effectively, what we've done is give ourselves till, in the case of one option, early 2022, and then the other till late 2022. To execute on these options and essentially give ourselves more time to explore this massive district in Mexico.
So what does this mean for exploration then? Because you still need to get this work done. The overall purchase price has not changed, but it does give you a little bit more breathing room, I think, rightfully so, because of the slowdown or shutdown that COVID has caused in Mexico.
Well, I think what it means for us is that we're in the strongest position that we've been in this whole time that we've been working on the Panuco project. And, the upside is so large here that we were drawn to it, despite the, what people might see as large payments for a producing district. But if we're successful, the potential for, very large silver district is so large that that giving us the potential to move into production is very worthwhile. So now we have more time to explore. We've already completed about 25% of our initial drill program, which is the discovery drill program. And that had been focused on the most productive area of the district, which is called the Animas Fame. Now we're actually moving over. We're going to be able to return most likely next week. Mexico's made announcements to the effect that we'll be able to remobilize our drill next week, early next week. And now we're going to go back to a whole new vein corridor that's actually the next western vein from the Animas corridor, and it's never been drilled. So we're going to go there and have the opportunity to drill this this very large vein corridor that's had as high as 3 kilos of silver in sampling at surface, and we're going to do that right away.
All right, let's touch on some of the recent drill results and sampling results that the company released. This is more or less two parts here. You had some drill results from this Animas vein corridor at this Honduras vein. Some of the grades we saw there include almost 4.5 meters at 275 grams per ton, silver equivalent, 2.6 meters at 232 grams per ton, silver equivalent. So those are the drill results. And then sample results that came from this Cordon de Oro vein corridor, these are much higher grade. We're seeing sample results of over 1 kilo silver equivalent. And one thing to note is that these are much higher gold components. Take us through, Mike, the differences between these two corridors and what these results have you guys thinking.
So we've been very pleased with our initial drilling. We struck out at first to drill some of the areas around existing workings and underneath existing workings on the Animas vein. As I mentioned before, the Animas vein is the most developed of the district. It has the most production history. Probably 90% of all production from that district has come from the Animas vein. It's a very established area. That's where the mill that we have under option is. So we thought the first step is really to understand, knowing what we could do, sampling underground in these old workings and then drilling underneath to really get an idea of how the mineralization behaves. And that's what we did. And we were very pleased with our initial drill results, 4.3 meters at 275. In that we have over 550 silver equivalent over a meter, 2.6 at 232 grams silver equivalent. In that, again, just under a meter at 460 grams silver equivalent. So those are good numbers. Those are in line with economic material in Mexico. If you look at reserve bases of miners, that's in line with that. But what's really encouraging is this this new area that we've discovered, essentially, the Cordon de Oro. Now, we call it Cordon de Oro because literally in English, that's corridor of gold. And the reason for that is because there's elevated gold at surface. And in that sample that you mentioned, we did 3.2 meters of surface sampling, and we found 44 grams of silver, but also half an ounce of gold, so 16.5 grams gold. But in that, we actually found a meter of 3 kilos of silver equivalent. But really, this should be in gold equivalent because it was 75 grams silver and just under 40 grams of gold, so 38.2 grams of gold. So really, really high grades, elevated at surface. And it's interesting because this corridor is just to the west of Animas. It's actually never been drilled. And it's only been mined just down from surface about 50 meters. So what we understand is that because of the topography, it's higher in the system, it's higher. And the same type of outcropping high-grade material that you see at Animas, which is lower, you don't see here at Cordon de Oro. So this gives us an opportunity to use the drill and test underneath some of these very high grade surface results. And we're very much looking forward to seeing what we can find there.
So when the drill does get over to this area, how deep do you envision some of these holes going for the exploration?
Well, that's actually interesting. So no one's drilled deep on this this project yet. And for us, we've been going between a total hole length is well under 500 meters, typically between 250 and 350. But depth, that's maybe 200 meters, maybe 300 meters in some cases. Here we'll have to see what we come across. But there's the potential to drill deeper. But typically, these are shallow holes.
Okay. How many meters are you planning on putting in this Cordon de Oro corridor?
It could be, probably about 2,500, could be more, but I believe we budgeted about 2,500 meters.
Okay. Now, there are other targets on this project, too. What's the timeline going to be to go test out some of these other corridors?
Well, we do that simultaneously. We have our teams basically going and generating these targets. We have a revolving list of 20 priority targets that we test, and we'll expect to bring another drill on most likely in June. So as we progress and build on the project, we'll look to add more drill rigs to test more of these opportunities.
Now, how about cash in the bank for the company to progress all of this exploration?
We have just over $2.5 million in the bank. So we're fully funded for the rest of the drill program. Of course, bringing more capital in would allow us to test more targets as we go. But now that we have an extension on the timeline, the budget that we have and the time budget, this should take us till probably sometime in fall of this year to complete this initial discovery drill program. Afterwards, we'll start to build resources on the targets that we've drilled.
Okay, so then after this round of drilling, you do intend on getting some resources out to the market?
Not after this round, but it would begin this is what we consider the discovery drill program. And following that, we'll look to delineate resources on the top ore shoots that we find during this program.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. De-risk some of those and know exactly where to go back to test the extent and then come out with a resource in reasonable time. All right, Mike, good chatting with you. Thank you for the update. If anybody has any follow-up questions for Mike and Vizsla Resources, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. That goes with all my guests and all the company updates I had this week. As I mentioned on the onset of this first hour, it was a busy week for company updates. I will post all those company updates or links to those company updates in the weekend show posting. So anybody listening on the radio, come to our website, kereport.com. Click on that weekend show posting and you can get replays of all of these segments and links to all of those company updates. Mike, really appreciate your time. Everybody who tuned in, thank you for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend, and I will be back with daily editorials throughout next week. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.